Twilight by Tuesday Lovesang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 4. It was a very nice sunny afternoon. Biggs, our guest from Vancouver, said, "Why don't I take you out this afternoon? Go anywhere you like." I thought of all the work to be done. I thought of all the letters to be answered, because I had been in hospital, and a number of people had been informed of it, explaining the delay in answering their letters, so everyone had started writing back, asking all manner of questions, and then people were asking more and more questions, so I would have to do something when I got out of the hospital. Yes, I have plenty to do. Then there was a book to be written. If it didn't get the typescript finished, the publisher couldn't give it to the printer to be set up. And then I thought, oh, well, it does say somewhere that all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. I'm a dull boy anyway, so I'll go out. I trundled onto the car in my wheelchair and, with the usual difficulty, got into the car. The wheelchair was folded up and put in the trunk, and off we went. This was my first trip out of the house since leaving the hospital some time before. Actually, it was the first opportunity I had had of seeing anything at all of Calgary, because we have no car. We have no television either. Sometimes I believe there are programs about a city on TV, but I am barred from that also. On this day, then, we took off and headed towards the mountains, leaving the city behind us, and went on climbing up the high rise of the foothills. First, though, we took a circuit around the hospital, the Foothills Hospital of Calgary, a very fine, very modern hospital, and the first thing we saw was a body being loaded from the mortuary into a hearse. We turned about and continued on over the river up into the rising ground. I could not go too far, because now I tire so easily and suffer so much pain. So we stopped for a time on high ground where we could look over the city. Quite a pleasant city it is, too, with the winding rivers, the Bow and the Elbow, threading their way through the city. The traffic was awful. We were told that there are more cars per capita in Calgary than anywhere else in North America, and I well believe it. People seem to zoom along without a care in the world. Well, there are quite good hospitals to receive them. All too soon the time came to return home, so we took a different road through a shopping center, and I must confess to considerable amazement at the way all the shops nowadays seem to be leaving the center of cities and going far out on the outskirts, leaving the center of the cities for what? Offices? I suppose it must be used for something. But we can't waste the whole day. The time has come to work, and I'm going to be an old crosspatch again, because I have a pet peeve. I do, indeed, hate it when people write to me as though I were a poor, benighted heathen, urgently needing salvation. For some extraordinary reason, do-gooders, holy Joes and holy Joesses, have been writing to me in increasing numbers of late, and sending me all manner of New Testaments. Old Testaments, good words, and all the rest of it. One woman wrote to me yesterday and said, I hope the light of the dear Lamb, the Lord Jesus, sparks a response in your heart. You can only be saved by the blood of Jesus. Well, fine. By the way she writes, a real vicious old so-and-so she is, about heathens, she needs some of that salvation herself. Anyway, I'm a Buddhist. I was born a Buddhist. I am a Buddhist. I shall die a Buddhist. Now, Buddhism is not a religion. It's a way of life. And the real Buddhists never try to convert others to their belief. Now, I understand there is some sort of cult who call themselves Buddhists, who go out like missionaries and yowl in the streets, while they are not true Buddhists. We have no missionaries, and I don't want any missionaries preaching to me. I had one of those in the hospital the last time I was in, and I soon convinced him I knew something about Christianity too. I firmly believe that unless we have a return to religion on this world, soon we shall have no world left. But I equally firmly believe that it does not in the least matter what form that religion takes. What does it matter whether one is a Buddhist, a Jew, a Christian, a Hindu, or anything else, so long as we believe in certain things? If we do, then we will act in a certain way, and my belief is, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. I never try to make converts, and I don't want people to try to convert me. So, will you remember that, please, all you incipient do-gooders? If I get these books, Holy Words, Holy Terrors, Holy This and Holy That, they go straight into the garbage unopened, because I find that the type of person who goes to the trouble of sending these things is usually the most ignorant and the most bigoted of all types of people. They're so set in their religion, so hypnotized by it, that they are not able to stand apart and study what really is the origin of a religion. Some of you seem to have been very greatly interested in the report in my last book, Candlelight, about Jesus going to Japan and about the report of the brother of Jesus being crucified as a substitute. So perhaps I should do what so many of you have asked me to do, say a bit more about some of the old Bible stories. A surprising number of people have written to me asking, more, more. Obviously, you must keep in mind at all times that there isn't much mention of any of this sort of thing except in the Bible. For example, none of the great writers of round about 2,000 years ago wrote anything at all about Christ. Now that's a thought worth pondering. Any event nowadays is written up everywhere in inaccurate detail, but with all the trimmings that the press can devise. But throughout history, great writers invariably wrote about events of moment. And the fact that none of the writers of crucifixion days wrote anything at all about crucifixion implies that Jesus wasn't known except to a very few people. Just remember this. Christianity did not come until long after Christ. Actually, the foundations of Christianity were set at the Convention of Constantinople, 60 years after the date of the alleged crucifixion. In the opinion of the great Greek and Roman writers of the day, Jesus was a sort of troublemaker, one who had certain ideas, and at the present day we should say, "Oh, he's just a member of a hippie gang," or "the leader of a set of robbers." Are you shocked? Well, you shouldn't be, you know, because you were not there. You do not know the facts. You only know what has been peddled to you through the Bible and Bible stories. Great writers of the day, whose words have survived and reach us now, made no mention of Jesus. Another thing to be considered is this. If a person were to be crucified, and then at the end of the day the person was removed from the cross, he could be revived. The crucifixion didn't kill him. Actually, being suspended by the arms, as on the cross, there were very serious difficulties and obstacles in the matter of breathing. It was impossible to take a full breath, because to take a full breath meant to expand the chest, and when one is suspended by one's arms, that can't be done. I have been so suspended in a prisoner of war camp, so I can speak from experience. So the crucifixion wouldn't kill. Instead, there would be extreme exhaustion, and soon the person would sink into a coma, during which his breathing would become very, very shallow, growing shallower, so eventually you could say that he died of suffocation. I understand much the same sort of thing occurs when a person is electrocuted. The muscles controlling breathing are paralyzed or impaired, and so there is not enough air taken in to make available to the brain the necessary oxygen with which to sustain consciousness. So, in that case, a person lapses into unconsciousness, and if neglected, the person would eventually die. If he could be removed from the source of electricity and artificial respiration given, he would in most cases revive. I was going to tell you some very interesting things, true things, about certain aspects of prison life in the USA. But for some reason, my publisher seems to think that what I originally wrote would cause great alarm to American readers. In deference to my publisher, I have to leave out certain parts, but I will suggest you get a hold of a book or two written by former prison governors in the USA. Some of these men have written very revealing books about certain aspects of prison life in the USA, and although my publisher will not let me mention these facts, the American publishers of the prison governor's books are not so nervous, so go along to your public library and see if you can find some titles of books by prison governors in the USA. Do you know that in bygone days there was a definite law that when a person was crucified, the body should be removed at nightfall? Before removal from the cross, the legs had to be broken so as to give the body an extra shock and an extra strain on the chest, and thus upon the breathing muscles, but let me remind you that in the case of Jesus, it was specifically stated that his bones were not broken. So if his bones were not broken, and if he did not get that extra shock, then possibly the body could have been revived. As I have said above, in the case of Jesus, the body was removed without the legs having been broken, and the body, no one has said it was a dead body, remember, was hustled away to a cave, and there it was received by a very special, very gifted band of men and women. You've heard of the Essenes. You have heard that they were a very special band of most knowledgeable people who had training and skills beyond the understanding of the average person in the street. They had an extraordinarily high knowledge of life and death. They knew what chemicals to use. They knew how to revive bodies. So, in the cave, very quickly, pungent aromatics were administered to the crucified person, and chemicals were injected, and eventually the body, whether it be Jesus or the brother of Jesus or someone else, it doesn't matter, was revived. To refresh your mind a little further, remember the case of Lazarus? Lazarus was reportedly revived from the dead, wasn't he? Now, there is that definite report. There is the report also that Jesus revived him. Well, Jesus was a member of the Essenes, so it's very likely that Jesus, a white magician, had certain herbs or powders with him that he could accomplish these seeming miracles. And such a miracle was worked upon Lazarus, who may have been in a coma. After all, there is a possibility that it could even have been a diabetic coma. Let me tell you something. I am diabetic. I have been in diabetic comas, and in such a state, in certain conditions, one can easily be taken for dead. Another type of complaint which simulates death is the complaint of catalepsy. Many people suffering from that have actually been buried alive, because the true cataleptic can undergo all tests except one. He has no responses, no reflexes, and a mirror held to his lips will not fog. There is only one test infallible in the case of catalepsy, the test of decay. If a body dies, it starts to decay, and after a certain time, one's eyes and one's nose give complete assurance that the body is indeed dead. But that does not happen in the case of a cataleptic, so possibly Lazarus was in a coma or cataleptic state, and Jesus, as a member of the Essenes, realized the condition and had the ability to treat it. If we do not know the technique of a thing, then it becomes a miracle, doesn't it? Particularly if, according to our own concept, it is against established law or belief or knowledge. Well, just remember that there are a certain number of books in the Bible, but there were many, many more books which had to be omitted from inclusion in the Bible. And the Bible, of course, is just a collection of books, as the word implies. Many other Gospels had to be left out because they contradicted the testimony of the few who were published. Think of this. It is nowhere said that the Bible is true. Instead, you have a statement, the Gospels according to Saint Somebody. In other words, we're getting fair warning that this is not necessarily a true book. Instead, it's a book which has been reported according to the words of a certain person. It's much the same thing as saying, well, he told me that he thought. That's not saying that you know it for a fact. Instead, according to the language of the lawyers, it could be classified as hearsay evidence, not something which is given to you as utter truth, incontrovertible truth, but as a statement according to someone else. If you could get a hold of other old books, papyri, or stone writings, you would find that there were truly remarkable divergences. Do you know, some books say that John never lived. Some people say that John was just a symbolical, mythical figure like John Bull in England or G.I. Joe in the USA or what is it, Kilroy was here. If you would do astral travel, as I suggest, you shouldn't have much difficulty in finding out these things for yourself, because there are still quite a number of documents going back 2,000 or 3,000 years, or even longer, which have not been discovered by physical man, but man in the astral, and woman in the astral too, can find these things and can read them. There is a great advantage because many of these papyri are stuck together with age, and if you tried to enroll them now in the physical, they might shatter into dust, but in the astral, you can go through them layer by layer without disturbing their physical structure. If you find that difficult to understand, get hold of a microscope somewhere and look at, let us say, a piece of rough stone. You can carefully focus your microscope and you can see different layers of the stone coming into focus, being quite clear, and then disappear to provide space for another focus. Anyone with a microscope can explain that to you. My wife has just read this, and she has made a worthwhile suggestion. She said, why not tell them that some people believe that Sherlock Holmes was a living person? Well, that's a good point, a very good point. Because Sherlock Holmes has been accepted as a living person, and people still write about him. I suppose the letters go to the estate of Conan Doyle, but Sherlock Holmes was a figment of the imagination of Conan Doyle. We know there was no such entity as Sherlock Holmes, but popular imagination has clothed that imaginary entity with an existence. In fact, in England there is, I believe, a club devoted to perpetuating the legend or myth of Sherlock Holmes. Well, I have mentioned using astral travel to get to see some of the undiscovered manuscripts, etc. During the past 20 years, I have had an enormous number of people write and tell me that now they can do astral travel. They can experience the reality of what I've been writing about. They tell me that after the first initial struggle, they felt that they had broken free and they could travel at will anywhere at any time. Unfortunately, a number of people have written to me calling me a fake, etc., etc., and saying all manner of things, which I'm sure they will regret, because they personally could not do astral travel. And I can only assume that if a person has the wrong attitude, if a person makes the wrong approach, has doubts or fears, then it's not so easy to do astral travel. To me and to thousands and thousands more, there is no problem. Or rather, the only problem is how to tell others how easy it is. Let's have a look at this astral travel thing again, shall we? You want to do astral travel. First of all, do you believe in astral travel? Are you convinced that there is such a thing as astral travel, which you can do given such and such conditions? If your answer is no, then go no further, because you will not be able to astral travel unless you are thoroughly convinced of its existence. You have to convince your subconscious mind, because, to my way of thinking, the subconscious and the astral body are something like a boy holding a helium-filled balloon. As long as the boy holds onto the balloon, it is quite literally attached to his body. But if the boy can be induced to let go the string, then the balloon will float upwards. The astral travel condition is like that. So, first of all, you must believe that astral travel is possible. And secondly, you must believe that you can do astral travel. When astral traveling, it is quite impossible for any entity or anything to cause you harm unless you are afraid. Now, if you think that that is strange, just think of this. If you sit back comfortably in a chair and you think of some imaginary ailment, and you think of all the pain and distress that such an ailment could cause, you then think that you may have it, so your heart starts to palpitate and you might feel a bit upset. Then you're sure you have something wrong with you, and your heart races even more, and soon, because of your heart racing, you'll get a gastric condition, so you'll feel bilious or something else. So it's quite possible for you to make yourself definitely ill if you believe you have some illness, which is perhaps incurable. In the same way, if you try to do astral travel, feeling sure that some bogeyman is going to jump out and pull your tail feathers or something, then you'll be afraid to do astral travel, and in that case, it's a waste of you trying. So, a third condition is that you must have no fear of astral travel. Fear will definitely prevent you from getting out of body. Assuming, though, that you are convinced of the truth of astral travel, and assuming that you're convinced that you want to do it, and being certain that you have no fear, then really, there shouldn't be any obstacle unless you want to astral travel for a bad purpose. For example, and this is true, I've had men of a sort write to me telling me they wanted to astral travel so that they could see girls undressing and so on. I had one man write to me and tell me that he wanted to astral travel so that he could be sure his girl was a virgin before he married her. That, I assure you, is absolutely true. and it's a good way to make sure that you don't astral travel at all. But assuming that you are able to satisfy the conditions, you believe in astral travel, you believe that you, given a bit of help, could travel easily, you have no fear, and you have no intention of using the ability for anything wrong, then you should sit down somewhere where it's not too light, not too dark, must be just neutral. Sit down so that you're completely comfortable, so comfortable that you're not aware that you're sitting down or lying down, and there are no sharp edges sticking into you. And then you definitely visualize yourself getting out of the body. Breathe regularly, make deep and rhythmic breaths, and then let your eyes, which are closed, roll up so that you are, in effect, gazing at a spot somewhere near your hairline. If you're bald, you'll have to imagine where your hairline would be. Your eyes, then, should be squinting to a slight extent so that their focus converges, as I've said, at about the hairline. Just take things easy. There's no point in rushing things, no point at all. Let things go at their own speed. Then, either one of three things will happen. You might suddenly find that you've made a jerk. If you jerk, then you might come back straight into the body, because it means that you've got out of the body but then took fright. The fright will have sent you right back in again. There's nothing to be worried about in that. You can, if you like, sigh with exasperation and start all over again. The second thing that could happen to you is that you might feel a very, very slight, well, I can only say numbness, which might start at the feet and spread upwards. It isn't quite a numbness, really. It's indescribable unless you've actually had it happen to you. It could be numb, it could be a slight tingling. But anyway, it's something different. You have to try and ignore it. It's perfectly normal, anyway. Some people, after this, find that they're almost in a cataleptic state. Their muscles tighten up and they will not be able to move. Well, be careful. Whatever you do, don't panic here. This is a very, very good sign, because you have your eyes shut, remember? And yet here, at this stage, you will find that you are able to see through your eyelids, but everything will have a golden tinge. And then, when you've reached that stage, you will find a swaying sensation, and out you'll go, straight into the astral, and you will see things brighter and more vivid and with a greater range of colors than you've ever thought possible. In the third condition, when you have rested, you will find possibly a swaying. You will experience a sensation that you're going through a tunnel toward a light at the far end of the tunnel. You'll be drifting upwards like a piece of thistle down on an evening breeze. Keep calm. That's all to the good, because soon you will find the light is growing larger and larger, and then you'll drift out of this tunnel and you'll find yourself in a far greater light. You'll find that you are actually in the astral world. The grass about will be greener, far greener than you've ever thought possible, and the waters about, perhaps a lake or a river, will be so clear that you'll be able to see the bottom. It's a wonderful feeling, a wonderful sensation, and if you think of going to a certain place, there'll be a sort of a blink, and you'll be at that place. Suppose, for instance, you've gotten out into the astral, and for a time you float a few inches above the ground, just looking about you, marveling at the conditions, wondering what to do next. You may want to explore in the astral world where everything is brilliant, where the colors are brighter, where there's a tingling sparkle in the air. Well, do so. It certainly will revitalize you. It will build up your psychic powers enormously. It is far better to do this and have some spiritual feeding. If you do that, you will find you will have no difficulty whatever in getting into the astral on any other occasion. But if you want to rush off somewhere for some materialistic purpose, and then you will find a few shocks. Suppose you want to go and see XY to see what he's doing. Immediately you think of him and think of his location, you get there. But you have left the brilliant surroundings and the beautiful atmosphere of the astral world. Instead, you are back on Earth again, in the astral state, admitted, still seeing things as people see them on Earth, with dull colors, dull people, muddy water, and if your friend, XY, is in a commercial mood, you'll find that his colors are pretty dim, too, and you won't like it a bit. My definite recommendation is that those who get into the astral should stay in that world for perhaps half an hour to get accustomed to it, because then they will find it so very much easier to get into the astral on other occasions. The big difficulty is, with most people, that they start off very well, indeed. They start getting into the astral, and then their body creaks. They feel strange tugs and swayings. Sometimes they get almost airsick because they're in such a state of nerves. Well, they get out of the body, and then they panic. Oh, what if I can't get back in again? Immediately they have that thought, bonk, and they are back in the body, feeling perhaps a bit dizzy. And if you ever do get back into the body like that and you feel sick and dizzy, make sure you lie very still. Try to have a sleep, even though it be only for a few minutes. Because until your astral body can get out of your physical and realign itself, and so enter correctly, you will have quite a bit of indisposition. So, no amount of aspirins will help you. All you need to do is get out of your body again and back in properly. It's like getting up in the morning and finding you've got the wrong shoe on the wrong foot. You wouldn't want to go about all day like that. So you change your shoes to the right feet, and in the same way, get out of your body again and back in properly. So that's all there is to it. I say that anyone who can comply with the conditions can do astral travel. Anyone at all. But if you are afraid or doubtful, then don't waste time, because you won't astral travel. Let me return to the original theme of this chapter, religion. I have said a few things about the Christian religion and about the various fighting factions of that religion. I have said that I have no religion, as Buddhism is not a religion. It's a belief instead. All right, what do I think of Buddhism? The more one studies Buddhism, the more one can appreciate the intrinsic value of it as a guide to living, and the more one can realize that Gautama was negative in his outlook. My personal belief, which I have never put in print before, is that Gautama, the prince, was too utterly sheltered from the hard facts of life, and then, when he suddenly became confronted with suffering and pain and death, then it turned his brain. It gave him a severe psychic shock. It upset his sense of values. It destroyed something essential to his being. So the prince Gautama left the palace, left all the comforts he had known, and became utterly disillusioned. My personal belief is that he became negative. If one studies the teachings of Gautama, let us say Buddha, which is more normal to Western people, one will appreciate that Buddha was negative. Everything was no-ness, and all life is suffering. Well, we know that isn't true, don't we? There are good times in life as well as bad times. So I believe that Gautama became far too negative in his outlook, but at the same time, he did produce for the world some very, very valuable precepts, and it was founded on the much older religion of Hinduism. So we have Hinduism as one of the older religions, and Buddha took valuable portions of the Hindu belief and formulated what was called Buddhism, in the same way that Christ did not wander in the wilderness at all. Instead, he traveled through India and into Tibet, studying all the time and being taught all the time the higher teachings of Hinduism, Buddhism, the Islamic belief, and others. And from that, he formulated that which became known in distorted form as Christianity. Again, we must be sure that we realize that the Christian of Christ was not the very altered version which was propagated in the year 60 to increase the power of the priests. Now, I've been forbidden to mention anything about these priests in this particular book, but I've already written about them in many of my books. Just for one illustration, to see what I'm trying to get over to you, but because of the new conditions, must not say outright, please read The Hermit on page 154. I still do not understand how a publisher who has published these things can now decide that they must not be published. It seems a question of double talk to me, but I'm supposed to be, and I have been told, too outspoken. Anyway, I am not mealy-mouthed, am I? Well, to get back to our bit about religion. These priests of the early days, because of their own peculiar, naughty-naughty outlook on life, I hope no one is blushing, taught that women were evil and everything about women was unclean, which of course is not the modern view at all. If you want to know the modern view, just read about the women's lib. And then you'll think that if women think that way, then possibly they are unclean. My own personal belief is that the only salvation available to the world at the present time is in a form of religion. It doesn't really matter what sort of religion. Any religion will do, provided you really believe it. You have your belief. I have mine. And if we are both people of good intention, then it will not matter that possibly some of the terms we use are different. The world now is a very dissolute place. Instead of being disciplined, young people do not respect age anymore. Children do not respect their parents. So if we make a religion which teaches such respect, then we're several steps ahead of the rest, aren't we? There must be a return to religion before the world can be set right. But one of the greatest things in religion is that we treat others as we would wish to be treated ourselves. That means we've got to share. We've got to give, because, quite truly, it's far better to give than to receive. It certainly makes you feel better if you find that you have really helped some other person. So, if we would all live as we think that other people should live instead of being a bit hellish ourselves and condemning anyone else who even looks the wrong way or is the wrong color, then we would be doing something. I try, as far as I am able, to live according to my own belief. And as I look back through the days, the weeks, the months, and the years of quite a long life, I see many things I could have done better. But never mind. I've got to the stage now where I can do nothing more about it. Although I get bad-tempered at times, plenty of you tell me so anyway, I still try to live according to my own belief, which is, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. There is another little saying well known in the Far East which also applies in living a better life, and it is, let not the sun go down upon your wrath. In other words, if you're having a fight with someone, make sure you knock him out and jump on him before darkness falls. Otherwise, if you astral travel, he may come along and give an astral bonk on some part of your anatomy. Seriously, though, you should never end a day on a note of anger, because it colors your reactions in the astral world, and it really does play havoc with your gastric secretions. Well, I can now cease my role as a preacher, and so I will dismount, complete with wheelchair, from my soapbox and say, that's the end of another chapter, isn't it? End of chapter 4.